Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, this week we're going to talk about the horrific unsolved murder of Daniel Morgan. Let me just set the context. Daniel was a private investigator who co-owned Southern Investigations with his business partner, Jonathan Rees. Daniel was murdered with an axe in a pub car park in London in 1987. Numerous failed police investigations by the Metropolitan Police have resulted in arrests and a trial, and the murder, however, remains unsolved. There was an independent investigation launched and a review in 2021 into the handling of the investigation by the Metropolitan Police, and that outcome has said that there is a form of institutional corruption which had concealed or denied failings in the case. Rees was arrested in April 1987 on suspicion of murder, along with ex-Detective Sergeant Sid Fillery and two brothers, Glenn and Gary Vian. They were all interviewed, but however, the case was dropped. No charges were brought against them. Then, in 2009, Rees, Fillery, Glenn and Gary Vian, and a man called James Cook all appeared at the Old Bailey. They'd been charged with Daniel Morgan's murder. However, the trial collapsed in 2011 after evidence obtained by Supergrass was deemed inadmissible in court. Shortly after the case, the activities of Rees as a private investigator became the centre of allegations concerning the conduct of journalists in the now defunct News the World newspaper. The case had been subject to podcasts by Peter Jukes and a book in conjunction with Alistair Morgan, Daniel's brother. Nazir, this is a big story, but not everybody will know about it.
No, there's been a drama about this. There's been documentaries about this. There's various reports. It's a stain. 35 years on, it's a stain on policing and justice in this country. And as you just outlined, the history is immensely checkered. And it obviously comes down to things that happened in the early days. And it happened similarly with Stephen Lawrence, if you remember, because of the really poor investigation and possibly corrupt investigation at the outset. It meant it was so difficult. It took 20 odd years, didn't it, to get convictions in that case. So I'm still hopeful. I'm sure that we're going to talk to Alistair in a moment. He's hopeful that at some point, somebody somewhere will be brought to justice for Daniel's murder. But it's looking less and less likely given time has passed and the various steps that you've just outlined. We've had a go at trying this case 10, 11 years ago. And for reasons which we might discuss, that failed. But as I said right at the outset, it is a stain. It's something that I think about quite a lot. And, you know, these are the kinds of cases that damage justice and damage confidence in the justice system and damage confidence in policing.
And we find ourselves again talking about the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? It almost feels like I'm stalking them. The Metropolitan Police, you know, are the largest force in the country, largest force in Europe. They are the best resourced. They have, in many respects, the best officers and certainly the most best investigators. But when you have 50,000 plus staff, you will have people amongst them that are incompetent, and you'll have some that are corrupt. And what we're going to discuss today, I imagine, is whether or not we're talking about incompetence here or, as the report said, corruption.
Absolutely. So we're joined by Alistair. Alistair, I'm very grateful for you giving up your time to come and speak to Nazir and I. This is something that, on one level, as an investigator, is something that people become passionate about and want to try and help. But this is personal. This is a family story. This is a case that's ripped your family apart. And before we get into the details, just give me the context. 35 years on, you still have no answers. There has been so many cover-ups in relation to this. How do you feel?
I think I feel resigned to the fact that I don't believe that anyone will ever be brought to justice for my brother's murder, because the case has been so profoundly messed up over the years by corruption, failure, etc., etc. Particularly, I think, in the early investigations. You know, it ruined it for all time, I believe, when the conduct of the case was so poor. That
Alistair, let me take you back to the beginning. What's the age difference between you and Daniel?
I was 11 months older than Daniel.
Right.
So we were very close together age-wise.
Just give me the scene. You I think your mum was the first person to receive a phone call from the police to tell her that your brother had been murdered. Tell me about that evening and the following days.
I received a phone call at about 6 a.m, very early on March the 11th, from my mother. She said to me, "Alistair, I've got some bad news for you," she said. "Brace yourself, so brace yourself." And then she said to me, "Daniel's dead." And I said, "What do you mean dead, Mum? What's happened to him?" She said, "I don't know." She said, "I don't know what's happened to him. I've had a call from the police, the Metropolitan Police, and they say they wouldn't tell me what had happened to him." And then I immediately, you know, I thought, oh dear, this sounds bad, because if it had been, if he'd died in a car accident or a road accident, then they would have certainly said he's died, you know, he was died in a road accident. So I thought, oh, there's something wrong here. She asked me then, she said, I was in Hampshire at the time, and she said, "Can you go up to London today, you know, as soon as you can, to Iris, who's Daniel's wife, and their two children?" And I said, "Yes, I will. I'll go up as soon as I can." And I then phoned Jonathan Rees. I phoned the office as soon as I hoped that somebody would be there. And I spoke to Jonathan Rees. As a result of our conversation, I immediately became suspicious at that point. And I went up to London.
So why did you become suspicious? So your conversation with Jonathan Rees, who was Daniel's business partner, what made you suspicious of him, yes?
Yes, I did feel suspicious of him. His demeanour just wasn't right, you know. And I went up to London and I saw Rees that morning, I think late morning in London, and I felt, and my suspicions were even more, even greater at that point. And I then went to the police. I then went round to the incident room, where I was interviewed by a detective inspector who started treating me like a suspect as soon as I'd sort of walked into the incident room. And I told him in no uncertain terms that I didn't appreciate that kind of treatment. I mean, the first question he asked me was, "What were you doing last night then?" You know, I mean, it was just openly, you know, suspicious when he had no reason at that point to be suspicious. I'd been in Hampshire the whole time. Anyway, the following day, I went round again to the police station and spoke to Sidney Fillery, and it was just a mess.
So just set the context. So Sidney Fillery, was a detective sergeant in the Metropolitan Police. He was working on the inquiry team.
Yeah.
And he then ends up joining Southern Investigations. Astonishing.
There was an inquest in April 1988, the year after the murder, at which one of the witnesses said that Rees and Fillery together had planned the murder, and that the plan was that Fillery would sort the investigation out, he would be on the squad investigating the murder, and he would subvert the murder inquiry and then go into partnership, take over my brother's position in the company. In fact, this is exactly what happened. Fillery took over Daniel's role in the company, and then they went on to become big favourites of the News of the World for illegally acquiring information and selling it to journalists.
So Sid Fillery is a police officer.
Yeah.
At the inquest, it comes out that there was a plan for Sid Fillery to go and join and take your brother's position alongside Rees.
Yeah.
Why did that not cause the Metropolitan Police to launch a huge investigation of corruption?
Well, what they did was they called an outside inquiry. I'd been protesting quite a lot by this time about, this was before, even before the evidence came out at the inquest, because I believe that Fillery had tried to get me out of London after the murder when I pointed the finger to Jonathan Rees. Well, somebody, I'm sure it was Fillery. You know. He rang the house, my sister-in-law's house, saying, "Alistair's getting in the way of the inquiry. Tell him to go back home to Hampshire." And I knew that I hadn't been getting in the way of the inquiry. And Hampshire police never even investigated that, you know, so I knew that there was something wrong with their investigation. Then after Hampshire had exonerated everybody, I was so shocked and angry that I decided then that I would not rest until my brother's killers had been brought to justice and this corruption had been exposed.
Let me just hold you there. Nazir, this is, I mean, we're only starting to slowly unravel the details of this case. We've got an inquest. We've got an external inquiry by Hampshire Police. We've got Alistair's account, which is factual in terms of what he knows. Shocking. Absolutely shocking.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we all know, those of us who worked in investigating and prosecuting know that the first few hours, never mind the first few days, are critical to a murder inquiry. We call it the golden hour or the golden day. You know, the concept is that's when you can get forensic evidence. That's when witnesses are prepared to talk, when you can get them as when they're, you know, they're not expecting you to come to them, et cetera, et cetera. So Alistair's point is absolutely right. The critical failings at that point will have damaged the investigation for the next 35 years. And, you know, evidently there were individuals, you know, Alistair's mentioned their names and others potentially who were on one level slow to move, on another level they were quite quick in ensuring that nothing was ever done. So the whole investigation was damaged in that first few months. And, you know, as Alistair said, trying to pick it up afterwards is really challenging. The fact that there were people out, you know, publicly saying in an inquest that there was some kind of conspiracy going on involving a former police officer, and the fact that another police force decided to simply brush over it, as Alistair has quite rightly pointed out. Sadly, Mark and I, we've seen this so frequently. You have incompetence, you have potentially corruption, and then you have cover-up. And people are not prepared to ask the questions that you were asking. You know, you as a, you know, a deceased brother were asking more pertinent questions than people in the actual investigation itself.
Anyway, after the Hampshire cover-up, which I call it without question, we were sort of out in the wilderness for a whole decade. Mm. My MP in Hampshire wasn't interested in doing anything about it. And eventually I did a journalism degree, because at that time I had this sort of rather fanciful idea that that journalism was the same as during the Sunday Times golden
thalidomide era. Investigation.
Yeah, the golden era, you know, Harry Evans and all that, and I came to live in London. And I didn't work as a journalist. In fact, I finished up working as a translator.
So, Alistair, I'm interested in you. So you decided to do a journalism degree was because you thought that that would give you an insight or an opportunity to kind of fight the call of your brother?
Yeah, I mean, it did, in fact, turn out to be very useful, because I met a lot of people who later became journalists, and some of them were able to help me because over many years I kept pounding the media, you know, saying, you've got to look at this.
I mean, good on you, Alistair, because actually, if you look at so many families, and you know, between us and Nazir, we've got an awful lot, and, you know, I'm currently dealing with Lee Boxall's family, Nicola Payne's family. These are the families that get left behind. So the police do their initial investigation, and then there comes a point that they walk away. They can't do any more, and obviously in your case, deliberately don't do any more. And it's left to the family to pick it up. And I think, Nazir, sometimes we forget that actually it is the family that, by and large, when we're talking about decades later where the case gets reopened and you finally get some kind of progress, that's because of the drive of the family, not because of the police.
No. Rarely would you find somebody that's not the family who champions the cause. But Alice is a classic example of somebody that just wasn't going to let go because you knew something was terribly wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody was prepared to listen to you. And the people who, the powerful people, weren't prepared to listen to you, so you took it upon yourself. Similar with Neville and Neville Lawrence and his the Lawrence family, and the fact that they pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, time and time again. Somebody has to speak for the dead. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's immensely admirable of you, Alistair, that you've pursued it as you have done, and realizing that you have to have other tools in order to be able to do so. So journalism being one of them, but you still came up against that brick wall. Absolutely. Time and time again. The wall was, the doors were slamming in your face.
Yeah, I mean, I when I came to London, my MP, Chris Smith, now Lord Smith, started, he took an immediate interest in the case, wrote hundreds of letters probably over the years, or a pile of letters this thick, you know, and but nobody in the Home Office was taking any interest. And then my mother got a documentary made. My mother lived in Wales, and ITV Wales did a first documentary on it, and that kind of gave us a impetus. And then when I came to London, Duncan Campbell from The Guardian did a quite prominent piece on it. And these little things that help you, you know, that you know that there are people out there listening, even if they're not the ones that can do anything, that keeps you going, you know.
You're not alone. That's your point.
Exactly, you keep going. And then the Met did an investigation behind our backs, which they told us was into the murder. And that, I thought, another provocation. How can you expect us to trust you if you're doing an investigation behind our backs? And I thought, you know, just one provocation after another. By this time, I was also lucky enough to find a very, very good solicitor, Raju Bhatt from Bhatt Murphy, who has been a fantastic advisor and supporter and counselor to me, because he's dealt with many, many cases like this, although I think this is the longest he's ever.
Alistair, I'm interested in your view in terms of the police. So prior to your brother's murder, what was your view of the police?
Well, I'd known that there was police corruption. I knew that. I mean, I can remember.
But did you trust the police prior to that? Did you think the police were, by and large, honest, truthful people?
Yeah, I did. But when I saw what happened in the early stages of the investigation and the way I was treated and the way, you know, they tried to get me out of London, then I was very, very suspicious then. When the Hampshire investigation opened, because I'd been the force that had driven that, or my family had been the force that had driven that, you know, the police to do that, I was kind of jubilant because I thought, oh, they wouldn't dare cover up something like this, you know, but then they did. So I had some confidence initially, but that was quickly snuffed out, you know.
Let's talk about the trial. Eventually, there was a trial, wasn't there?
There wasn't actually a trial.
It didn't get that far. You're right. But individuals were charged. Those that Mark mentioned, and then the judge, I think rightly dismissed the case because there were concerns about the way the police and to that, for that matter, the prosecution had prepared the case.
Yeah.
There was a number of what they call supergrass witnesses, I think. That's a term I don't use anymore, but witnesses, and their credibility was being doubted by the judge. Yeah. There was very lengthy legal arguments, and at the end of that, the judge said that the judge wasn't going to allow the jury to hear the witnesses give their evidence.
Yeah.
And additionally, there were tens of thousands of pages of prosecution evidence, you know, documentary evidence in the main, that had not been disclosed to the defence. As the defence argued, fairly, in my view, that they couldn't get a fair trial. And so the case stopped. Now, here you are, 2009, suddenly you've got your hopes up again, and those hopes are completely and utterly destroyed again. How did you feel?
Well, I'd been fighting for 25 years. No, it's 2011. Which would have been then 24 years or something like that. Yeah, 24 years we've been fighting. And then the case was thrown out of court. And I think that was probably one of the worst periods of the whole thing, you know, because I knew that there had been corruption in this case. And I'd made a promise to myself and to my brother, or, you know, after the Hampshire investigation, that I was going to see this through. I then started spending full time, virtually, a whole year lobbying various media outlets, saying, look, you've got to do something about this.
So in terms of the disclosure, I'm interested in terms of what you've had disclosed to you, material-wise. Have you had disclosed, because obviously there was a trial, so that information was disclosed to your solicitor in respect of a lot of that, I hope. How much material have you actually had disclosed to you about the case?
Very little, really. There are millions of, you know, I mean, a sort of 1.5 million documents. You know, there have been 5 investigations into this case, and there are huge amounts of documents in there.
Have the Metropolitan Police shared with you the majority of their information?
No.
And the reason for that is what?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is it would be illegal to give us all the case papers. The problem that the panel had getting them all was significant. So they're not going to give my family 1 million papers, are they? I don't want them. You know, what would I do with them?
Exactly. Alice makes a good point. When the panel were discussing, inquiring into the circumstances of Daniel's death and subsequent police investigation, they complained that the Metropolitan Police were, I think they used the word slow to provide them, the legally enforceable independent inquiry with documentation. And of course, Cressida Dick herself was criticised by the inquiry in relation to that. So the idea that Alistair might get anything or his family might get any of that is pretty anathema. Yeah. But secondly, what would Alistair do with it? You know, it's for the investigators and the prosecutors to look at it in any great and do something with it, not Alistair.
I suppose you're right. But I suppose the problem is that Alistair's been the driving force behind this. And, it's been down to him to be able to drive this. I mean, Alistair, when you heard that that an independent inquiry was being set up, which started in 2021, what was your thoughts about that?
Well, we had been lobbying the Home Secretary. What had happened, the way the events went, was that my solicitor sent in an application to the Home Office for a judicial inquiry and a proper legal submission to the Home Secretary, who was at that time Theresa May. And Theresa May was considering this document. At some point over the year, after the collapse of the prosecution in 2011, at some period during that year, in the year in between, she said to us, I won't make a decision on this until the Met have submitted a document explaining why the trial collapsed. Now, we waited and waited and we waited and badgered the Met, you know, come on, we've been doing this for 25 years, don't mess us around. Anyway, they took a whole year to come up with this document. And I remember being presented with it by Cressida Dick and another senior officer at the offices of the Crown Prosecution Service in 2012, in the summer of 2012. We were given half an hour, I think, to look at the document before Cressida Dick and DAC called Simon Foy. And then we were looking at it, and my solicitor, he said, this is just cut and paste, he said to me, one of my assistants could have put this together in 3 weeks. They were trying to delay, and they used this tactic again and again and again, you know?
At the point when it happened, when it was announced, did you think, finally, we might get some answers.
In terms of how the investigations were conducted, it is detailed evidence of how they were conducted. And after which the panel themselves concluded that the Met had been more interested in protecting their own reputation than they had been in apprehending my brother's killers.
Alistair, we've heard that so frequently, haven't we? You know, not just the Met Police, but institutions generally are more interested in protecting themselves than doing the right thing. And your family are victims of that whole same approach.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you think, Alistair, they ever had you at the centre? So
no.
Nazir and I are very clear, is that, you know, victims are at the centre of everything that we do. You know, it is built around them. Cases are built around them. Did you ever feel, do you feel now, that the Metropolitan Police have ever put you at the centre of this and actually kept you updated and cared for you?
At some points. I mean, I've had private conversations with police officers on say the fourth or the fifth investigation, who've told me, they said, I mean, I remember one of them telling me that he was ashamed of the first investigation. And I mean, there are decent police officers out there, you know. It's not like, I mean, institutional corruption doesn't mean they're all bent.
No.
It means that there is an institutional attitude which infects many cases, I would imagine, whereby preserving their reputation becomes the top line.
I mean, Alistair, I'm being frank and honest with you. Over the years, I've come across very senior officers in the Met who said to me privately, they are, as you said, ashamed, embarrassed, devastated that other fellow officers were involved in cover-ups of the nature that you've just described. They didn't join the police service to do that. They joined to protect and bring bad guys and bad girls to justice. And they themselves are offended when people behave as they did in relation to your case. And we need to weed them out. You know, we need to identify them before they do the damage that they did in your case.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they do find them, hit them hard. Don't cover up for them. Don't coddle them. Don't, you know, make excuses for them.
Because, well, that's a really good point you just made, because Mark and I are very keen on accountability. Hampshire did this inquiry that you just described where nothing happened. Was anybody held to account for doing
that? No, I mean, they tried. They arrested and charged Jonathan Rees, and another man called Paul Goodridge, whom I never believed. When I started looking at that afterwards, I thought I never believed he'd had anything to do with this,
Right.
And I felt he was just a...
stooge?
A stool pigeon that they could just point the finger at. And then,
what I was trying to get at, though, Alistair, is those who carried out these various incompetent, corrupt investigations, et cetera, where's their accountability?
There is none. Senior officers of the most senior rank in the Met have lied to us about the quality of...
Has anybody been disciplined for their actions?
No, I think the only person who's ever been disciplined in a way was an exhibits officer who was given words of advice in the first... He was a young teenager of an exhibit officer, you know?
Yeah, I know. And he's a fall guy.
Yeah.
What can I say? I mean, unfortunately, Alistair, that is far too common. The people, the most junior ranks, tend to be held to account for the failings of their supervisors and their managers.
Alistair, go as far as you will with this. What do you think? And obviously, bearing in mind the potential legal process, but tell me, what do you think happened to your
brother and
why?
I think he was murdered because he was going to expose police corruption, that he was a threat to criminals and corrupt officers. In the days and weeks before his murder, he was consistently worried, expressing concern about police corruption. 2 days before he was murdered, he said, for example, he was a classic car enthusiast. You know, his hobby was getting old cars and restoring them. He had an old Austin Healey that he had restored over years, and he was a member of the Austin Healey Club. And he told a club member at a rally 2 days before he was killed. On a Sunday, he was killed on a Tuesday evening. And he told them that he told two people there. He said to one of them that he believed his partner and a police officer had been involved in a cash robbery, where £18,000 had been taken. And he also said to another that he was thinking of going to an outside force over police corruption. And then 2 days later, he was dead, you know. I don't think we know the whole truth there at all, you know. But that's, you know, that's what we have. I'm thinking now, I'm 73 years old now, and I've spent the vast majority of my adult life has been spent dealing with police corruption. And it's up to the people now, the rest of the public, what kind of policing they want.
Alistair, there's one person who could quite easily, and in past other people, of course, previous commissioners of Metropolitan Police, who could make a difference. They could decide, do you know what, once and for all, let's lay this out, let's put this to bed. Why has the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Cressida Dick, acted in the way that she has? There's no doubt the inquiry, Nazir has just said, alluded to the fact that the Metropolitan Police were being obstructive.
Yes, they were being obstructive.
So why doesn't she? What have you had a meeting with Cressida Dick?
No, I met her at that point back in 2012 when they came in with this shoddy little report, you know, that had succeeded in delaying Theresa May's decision for a whole year. I mean, and then when the panel was, when Theresa May finally decided to start the panel, and the panel had been formed with our agreement, it was done very fairly, you know, we had to agree all the appointments with the Home Office, and then it started, and then she began almost immediately. They had terrible trouble getting the documents right from the outset, and Cressida Dick was in charge of the disclosure. And at one point, she suggested to the judge who had been appointed to lead the panel, a retired judge, she entered into correspondence with him and he with her privately, without the panel's knowledge initially, about him being, she wanted him only to see certain documents. And when this came out, the panel collapsed, right? I mean,
you've lost trust, haven't you?
Well, yeah. And I think that, well, she was responsible for that, in my view, because the panel were all, they all had all the security
vettings,
yeah. you know. And anyway, the judge then had to resign, and then we had to reconstitute a new panel. Some of the old panel were there, but then we had to agree a new chair to the panel. And I mean, that delayed it the best part of another year. And my mother died during this process. You know, she died in at the end of 2017. The panel had already been going for more than 4 years by that point, you know. And we were told it would take one year by the Home Office. So I dislike Cressida Dick intensely. I have no time for her at all, you know.
Nazir, I joined the police force because I wanted to make a difference. I gave an oath to the Queen, and my view was that justice always is the centre of what I do. You know, it's about truth, it's about being fair, it's about being honest,
yeah,
but it's about justice. How is it that a police officer, and I'm not just focusing on Cressida Dick here, I'm talking about police officers. How is it that police officers get into that role and utterly lose sight of that? There, when you get right to the top of the ladder, you have the amazing opportunity to make a difference, to help people, to do the right thing.
It's a cultural thing, Mark. I mean, leaders set the culture of the organisation, don't they? And the organisation... What if, as Alistair said, the most important thing for some organisations is how they're perceived. What do people think of them rather than what they do? And they'll do everything in their power to protect that quote-unquote reputation at the expense of doing the right thing, at the expense of doing justice, at the expense of following inquiries through to their natural conclusion. And they don't care, sadly, what people like Alistair and the many others have to go through, because they're more obsessed with their own positions and their own institution. And, you know, the first thing that I learned a long time ago was actually the best thing you could do is to admit you're wrong. Mm. And if you admit you're wrong, you get more confidence. People begin to believe you more. People begin to think.
But do you think that's just mindset that changes? I cannot believe. I'm such an honest, straight person that I couldn't get to a position where I ended up covering something up because of for an organization or that. How do you must go through some kind of mindset to change your attitude
exactly.
to do that? Because I firmly believe you're not like that when you join.
No, I'm sure you are. Well, some obviously a few maybe, but the vast majority aren't.
They
become institutionalized. What is most important is the organization that's paying your salary and not the people who you're meant to be helping. And it's a disgrace. I can't think what it must... Because it never happened to me and it never happened to you. So we're trying to put our minds in the places in the minds of people whom we don't understand. But the point is, there are others that should have been calling it out. This is the thing that always bugs me, actually, Mark, is that, yes, there are corrupt officers, there are incompetent officers, but there'll be other officers around them who will know what they're like, you know? And they mm-hmm. needed to whistleblow, and they needed to say something about mm-hmm. it, and they needed to do something about the information they had at their sure. fingertips, and they chose not to. And that makes them, sadly, as culpable as the mm-hmm. person who did cover it up in the first place.
I know a former Met police officer who stuck his neck out about corruption, and he and his colleague were ostracized, bullied. You know, there's this whistleblowers are treated very badly sometimes in these organizations. This is another aspect of the
problem. Oh yeah, they're scared. They're scared to speak up. Attacks their career, affects their career. But again, it comes back to leadership, Mark. Mm. You know, if your leader said, I'm encouraging you to speak up, and I will protect you with every bone in my body, then that creates the culture where people do speak up. Yeah. If the leader says, shut up, everybody. We're under attack from outside. Mm-hmm. We can't have people within our ranks trying to paint us in a mm-hmm. negative picture publicly. Then that's exactly what happens. And the whistleblowers mm-hmm. do get scared out or kicked out or denied opportunities or career progression.
Close ranks, don't they? Close ranks entirely.
That's the word. Close ranks comes from organisation with ranks. So, you know, when you have a hierarchy of the nature that the police have and other institutions have, they will do as the leader does.
I just want to kind of finish on a last few points, which is where next? So what's the next fight for you? You're without being rude, you're an elderly man now, and moving on.
We're at present suing the Metropolitan Police. As my solicitor said to me, that is probably the only kind of accountability you get from them.
And how far are you down the road with that?
It's a lengthy process.
It's a lengthy process.
Yeah. But anyway, that's where we are. And I'm letting him... I mean, there's a lot of work for me to do in that as well, but I'm letting him guide...
As a proper investigation, I know Peter Jukes did a very good podcast, but has a program or a film been made about this?
There's been documentaries, several.
With the proper truth, with the real evidence and truth out there?
Certainly critical documentaries. I know that some, I know a couple of people who were working on a drama, a television drama, which I think can sometimes be more effective.
Yeah. People, it resonates more with people.
It resonates more with people. And that is going on at the moment. But again, that's a very slow process. The industry isn't exactly blooming at the moment.
I mean, Alistair, I really hope that you get some justice. I hope somebody speaks up, somebody who knows something directly involved in all of this, can't live with themselves, and finally, after 35 years, says, right, I need to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I believe the man who did it actually wielded the axe is dead now, you know.
Who's that?
Glenn Vian.
Right, you think he actually killed your brother?
Yeah, I'm positive he was the one who did it.
Alistair, I can only say thank you so much for speaking to us. Nazir and I are very grateful. The impact on families after crimes like this is horrific. And it just goes to show that actually, if you hadn't have continued to fight for this, like so many other families who are left in the wilderness, it would have been forgotten. The Metropolitan Police and those officers who had involvement in the case need to hold their head in shame and disgust at what they've done. And I can only thank you very much. So certainly on behalf of myself and I know all of our listeners, thank you so much for coming on.
It's very nice to meet you all. And I'm very sorry, Nazir, to hear about your brother.
No, thank you. I mean, obviously, we're all at the stage now of 2 years into lockdown. He died in the first week of lockdown. So, you know, it's something that you never lose with. And we've all lost somebody that we loved. And I think we just need to remember that in whatever way, if we've lost them and something could have been done something about it, then we need to keep fighting for justice. I'm in awe of what you do, Alistair.
Yeah, Alistair, thank you so much. You have our support and I'm sure our listeners' support. So if we can ever do anything to help you, you know where we are. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks very much, Lynn. Bye.
Bye, Alistair.
Nazir, incredible story. I mean, that case I've certainly been aware for a very long time, but it isn't one that's that well known. It's shocking. I mean, this is institutional cover-up right to the very top of the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah. I mean, I first became aware of it during the trial 10, 12 years ago. It wasn't my case, but I was certainly aware of when it collapsed. And I thought, hang on, there's something not right there. So I did my reading and thought, there's something not right here. It's as simple as that. It was obvious to anybody that explored this case with any length of detail that you were up against a corrupt institution, corrupt officers. There was a hell of a lot more to this story than ever met the eye. And as we discussed with Alistair, the massive failings at the beginning have absolutely, perhaps fatally damaged this case. And, you know, it goes to show that, you know, I'm afraid miscarriages of justice work both ways, where the guilty actually are not convicted because of people standing in their way, covering it up, protecting their reputations and being corrupt, as we've identified. So, we need a complete and utter cleaning of our system. And it has to start with policing, because policing, you know, they uphold the rule of law. Without the rule of law, we're nothing. And I think it really has. We can't keep tinkering a new commissioner here or a new bit of law here. We need a royal commission that looks at policing afresh. Yeah, and decides what should it be, who should be there doing it, what powers should they have, and how transparent and open should they be.
And it's shocking, these individuals' behaviour, going back to the very first investigation, those people that knew what had taken place and those people that have then covered it up. And I'm utterly disgusted in those individuals. Yeah. And I hope those individuals, trouble sleeping, I hope that they have all the demons that can possibly be brought to their side, because they have, as a direct result of their behaviour, led to the torment that Morgan's family have been through. His mum died without knowing what happened and believing, of course, and rightfully, that the Metropolitan Police did all they could to cover this up. Yep. We ask ourselves every week, and I find myself getting more and more angry with the roles of certain people in the police force. And yet again, we've got the very people that we rely on, because there isn't anybody else to keep us safe, are the very people that have constructed it to deliberately evade justice.
Yeah, absolutely. And one law for some, other laws, the bulk of us don't get anything like the protection. But if you and I stepped out of line, rest assured they'd throw the bricks at us, wouldn't they? It really is shocking, devastating, dare I say it, shameful. It is really shameful. I went into justice to bring justice, not to hide criminals. And that, sadly, is what some people have managed to do.
Absolutely. A very somber moment, and sadly, to finish on. Nazir, as always, fantastic to talk to you. Please do tell your friends about Feel Favour podcast. It's slowly growing its audience. And I think it's something that we certainly are both passionate about, bringing you the real life stories and getting behind the detail for you. So please do follow us. Let us know of the things that you like or they don't like, and any particular subjects that you'd like us to talk about. Well, until next week, Nazir, thank you very much. You look after yourself and your family. Take care.
All the best.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.